Chapter 4 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 4. Life in those days of boyhood at Winchester and Oxford was pretty well rose-coloured all through, once the first two nightmare years of Winchester were over. A wild rag at school and the university, and a constant succession of amusement, sport, luxury and pleasure at home. I think I have put it concisely in one of the sonnets in my poem In Excelsis, written more than 30 years later, in my cell at Wormwood Scrubs Prison. For I was of the world's top, born to bask in its preferment where the augurs sit, and where the devil's grace, to counterfeit, is all the tribute that the augurs ask. As I am bound to make the attempt to give a true picture of myself, to set against the ludicrous caricature that is to be found in such books as Frank Harris's Life and Confessions of Oscar Wilde, and the equally idiotic outpourings of Mr. Robert Harborough Sherard, I suppose it is necessary to say that I was, until I met Oscar Wilde in my third year at Magdalen, Oxford, very much like other boys of my class and upbringing. I was, I think I may say fairly, without fear of contradiction, very popular, and had a great many friends. I put them in inverted commas because, with two or three exceptions, they all, more Anglicano, left me in the lurch when the time came. At school and at Oxford I took nothing very seriously. I learned very little at Winchester, and at Oxford I acquired only a certain amount of knowledge, more or less by accident, and because, although I neglected the work I was supposed to be doing, I did indulge in a great amount of miscellaneous reading. I was never any good as a cricketer, and though I was fairly good at football, I never could take games as seriously as the average English boy takes them. But I was a good runner, and only the bad luck of being ill prevented me from doing well in the sports in my last year at Winchester. I won the school steeplechase, 2.5 miles across country, when I was 16, in 1887, and I feel pretty sure that I would have won it again from scratch the next year, my last, if I had been able to run. But, unfortunately, I was in bed with a bad cold, and unable to compete in that event, and my illness ruined my hopes in the mile, where I would have stood a good chance. At Oxford, I won the 2 miles race at the Magdalen College Sports, after being second the year before, and I also won the mile handicap. I won these events quite untrained, and if there had been in those days anyone whatever to take interest in me, from a running point of view, I would have undoubtedly made a good show as a 3-miler, and might have got my blue. As it was, I threw away my chances on the only occasion on which I ran in the varsity sports, in the 3 miles, by running with a plaster bandage round my left knee. Although I was not properly trained, I fancied myself to win the 3 miles, and I had privately tested myself to be, as I thought, good enough to win it. But, as evil fate would have it, on the day before the race, a friend of mine who was with me on the running track pointed out, what I had scarcely noticed before, that I had a slightly swollen vein behind my left knee. I went the next day and showed it to a doctor, and he assured me that it was of no consequence, and did not amount to a varicose vein, but at the same time he said he could fix me up with a bandage, which would make it perfectly safe to run. He accordingly encased my knee in a stiff plaster. It seems almost incredible that he should have been such a fool, and that I myself should have been such a fool as not to realise that the result of this bandage round my knee was to shorten my stride and put a frightful handicap on me. I ran in the 3 miles, and after going just over 2 miles, and finding that I could scarcely keep my place, about fourth, and that I was 25 yards behind the leader, and ultimate winner, I dropped out utterly puzzled and disheartened. At the time I could not understand it, as I knew my form in this race was too bad to be true. But I was so upset and so disgusted, I had told a few of my friends that I was going to win, that I gave up running from that day forth. It was not till years afterwards that it occurred to me that this wretched bandage was the cause of my discomfiture. I do not, of course, say that I would certainly have won the race without the bandage, but I had run a trial 3 miles about a week before with a man who had his blue for 3 miles, and I had beaten him very easily by quite 100 yards. So, obviously, if I had run my true form, I should have been there or thereabouts at the finish. I suppose at my age I can talk about my personal appearance in my youth without being denounced for vanity. Frank Harris, in his self-admitted perversion of the truth, as far as I am concerned, entitled The Life and Confessions of Oscar Wilde, says that at the time when he, Harris, first met me, which was in my 24th year, I was pretty in a girlish way. This, of course, is the merest malice. There was nothing then, nor has there ever been, anything in the least effeminate about either my appearance or my manners. After all, there is plenty of evidence on this point, the evidence of numerous photographs and pictures, and eyewitnesses by the hundred. There can be no object in pretending that I was not rather exceptionally good-looking as a boy, and it is a fact that I went on preserving my looks and youthful appearance in a truly remarkable way right up to the time I reached the 40s. 2 years after the Wilde affair, when I was in my 27th year, I happened to be in Monte Carlo for a few days with my mother. I went to the casino and was refused admission on the ground that I was too young to go into the gambling rooms, the rule being that no one under 21 years can be admitted. After arguing vainly for some time with several polite officials, I finally went off and found my mother. She accompanied me back to the casino and, producing her card, assured the head official that I was her son and that I was nearly 27. The official thereupon gave me a card of admission with many apologies, saying, "I hope, my lord, you will excuse me, but I have a son of 16 and he looks much older than you do." It is curious that when I went to the casino 2 years before, in company with Oscar Wilde, just before his prosecution of my father, I was admitted without question, even though I was then only in my 25th year. Right up to my 40th year, I could at any time have passed for a boy if I had wished to do so, and in fact I have often done it just for a joke. All I required as a preliminary was a week or 10 days shooting and hard walking in Scotland, or a few gallops or other form of strenuous exercise to clear my eye and get a good colour. With this preparation, I would have undertaken to bet that I could go down to Winchester, put on a school straw hat, and pass entirely unnoticed as a schoolboy among a group of schoolboys. When I was 31, and owned a racing stable at Chantilly, I was one day playing the piano in the drawing-room of the Hotel Condé, where I was then living, when the old French Baron de Rothschild came into the room. I stopped my very imperfect execution of Chopin's First Polonaise and got up. Whereupon the dear old lady begged me to go on playing, and entered into conversation with me, complimented me on my French accent, and asked me if I was at school in France. It was just about that time that I first met my wife, then Miss Olive Custance, and we were married a year later. She can confirm what I have written about my appearance at that time, and the fact that it scarcely changed during the next 10 years. I am obliged to go into all this because I am now approaching the most difficult and embarrassing part of my task in writing these memoirs. I mean my association with Oscar Wilde. Anyone who knows anything about life as it really is in England at school, at the university, and later, and who is not a party to the hypocritical wholesale lying and suppression of the truth, which, up till quite lately, was de rigueur on this sort of question, will know that, my appearance being what it was, I was exactly the type which attracts boys and men quite as much as it attracts women and girls. I decline to go on sticking to the convention which has hitherto forced me to suppress the truth. I did it in a former book because I was then advised by the man who helped me to write it, T.W.H. Crossland, to wit, that to do otherwise would be equal to committing suicide. I have already told the truth about this matter in the witness box, which is the most public confessional in the world, and I am going to tell it once more in this book, just as I wanted to do when I wrote my book, Oscar Wilde and Myself, in 1914. I was persuaded not to tell the whole truth then, but now I am much surer of my ground, and I am convinced that nothing but truth can serve me. When I was at school, as I have already indicated, I learned, after much initial repugnance and resistance, to do what everybody else did. By the time I was in my last year at Winchester, I was neither better nor worse than the other boys in my house. My moral sense had been completely destroyed, and as to religion, it simply did not exist in my day at Winchester. To say that it was treated as a joke would be a euphemism. It was treated with utter contempt, ridicule, and blasphemy. There was a picture of the Last Supper, a reproduction of Da Vinci's picture, hanging over the high table in the dining room of our house. One of the boys, who was a prefect, and certainly the most powerful and influential boy in the house, he was in Commoner 6 at football and in the School 11, used to make a practice of hurling a piece of bread at this picture every time he came in to tea, there being then no master present, his object being to hit the figure of our Lord. I give this as a comparatively mild instance of the attitude towards sacred things that existed, and in this connection I may refer back once more to Ideal Ward, whose son, the late Mr. Wilfred Ward, quotes his father as saying about the Winchester of his day, "It is impossible to conceive anything more like hell." I am inclined to say ditto. When I was a boy at Winchester and at Oxford, I had many fine friendships, perfectly normal, wholesome, and not in the least sentimental. Such was my friendship with Encombe, which lasted till he died at the age of 29. I had other friendships which were sentimental and passionate, but perfectly pure and innocent. Such was my friendship with Wellington Cotton. I had others again which were neither pure nor innocent. But if it is to be assumed from this that I was abnormal, or degenerate, or exceptionally wicked, then it must also be assumed that at least 90% of my contemporaries at Winchester and Oxford were the same. I cannot consent to tell the truth about myself without also telling it about other people, though I shall be careful not to mention names. There is nothing more dangerous and more certain to expose one to violent abuse and hatred than to tell the truth in England, even in the witness box, when one has sworn on the Bible before God to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. But to get back to my boyhood and youth, I say once for all that I was not at all abnormal or degenerate. I was perfectly healthy and natural, and to quote the words in the witness box of my family doctor, whom I called as a witness in my libel against the Evening News, "Above the average, both mentally and physically." 50,000 other boys might have done, and did, as a fact, do, exactly what I did. But, unlike me, they have not been compelled by a cruel fate to act the lifelong part of a scapegoat, and bear the whole force of all the concentrated hypocrisy and sham virtue which, in these matters, has made England a byword among the nations of the world any time during the last 300 years. It is an outrage that I should be obliged at my age, after being married for 26 years, and with a son of 25, to put all this into print. If I had been treated, I will not say fairly, but with the remotest approach to humanity and decency, it should never have become necessary. No other living creature has been treated as I have been treated, and has invoked in vain, as I have done, the law of his country to help him against a conspiracy of persecution and blackmail which has gone on for more than 30 years, and is still going on to this day. End of chapter 4.